The dead won't bother me. It's the living you gotta worry about.
Something, if I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
I'm Janelle.
We're back again this week to record. I feel like we were just here recording.
Weren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
We're very busy people.
Yes, there's a lot going on in our lives. We'll probably have some things to tell you about soon. I don't know.
Yeah, most of the things that go on in our lives are not related to
this
at all.
No, not really. Hopefully not, because then it'd be like probably murder.
Well, also, you know, podcasting.
Not
necessarily.
Yeah.
He goes straight to killing.
Just like, I don't want to be on my own podcast.
Yeah, no. Maybe one day. You never know.
You never know.
Might become unhinged.
Everyone. And when people know that that we do a podcast, they're always just like, I don't want to end up on your podcast. I'm like, well, then don't do the thing.
Yeah. Don't do the crimes. It's very simple.
We've got a great show for you this week. If this is your first time listening, a special hello to you. Let's head over to the newsroom. So this week, our news comes from NDTV, where a man named Kevin Duger was recently released after spending 20 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. You might have seen this because around here it's kind of big news. So in 2005, Duger was convicted in Cook County for a murder and received a 54-year sentence. 20 years later, Kevin Duger's twin brother, Carl Smith, who was already serving a 99-year sentence, confessed to authorities that he had, in fact, committed the murder.
Twin crimes.
Twin crimes. And they're identical twins.
So identical DNA.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And okay, so this is again from NDTV, quote, in 2014, he signed a sworn confession. However, in 2018, a judge ruled that Mr. Smith's confessions were not credible and refused his brother a new trial. The court cited Mr. Smith's 99-year prison sentence as one of the reasons, opining that Mr. Smith had done nothing, had nothing to lose now by claiming he was the shooter and thereby saving his brother. Mm-hmm. Which I get from that perspective, but mm-hmm. Duger was finally granted a new trial in 2021, and he was eventually released in January 2022. I think he had gotten some new attorneys that refiled. Mm-hmm. So, interesting case of mistaken identity.
But not really.
Yeah.
Because the identity is essentially the same.
Yeah. And, I mean, just one in another long line of wrongful convictions in Illinois.
That should be like a thing. Like if you find out that the suspect has an identical brother or sister, you should be like, all right, well, we just got to cross our T's and dot our I's and double check.
Yeah. Like an extra requirement of verifying alibis of the sibling.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. I wonder how that would work in practice. How often like a twin commits a crime. Are there statistics?
There's thousands of movies about it. So it's got to happen.
Twin crimes.
Right? There's always like, ooh, and then they discover he has like a long lost twin.
Oh my gosh. The evil twin.
Right? I watched some stupid movie that had that essential like plot twist in it.
Like it was the twin?
With Henry Cavill, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. I forget the guy's name, but his one twin was like severely abused and had a intellectual problem. And the other twin was totally fine in the mastermind.
Oh my God.
And they were like
the fuck?
Switching all the time. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so bad. But yeah,
okay.
There's lots of plot lines about it.
Oh,
so I'm
God.
Sure it happens.
Yeah. Okay, moving right along to Netflix and Kill. This week we're talking about The Puppet Master Hunting the Ultimate Con Man. This is a documentary that looks at the story of Robert Hendry Freegard, who was a 51-year-old man from England that claimed to be MI5. He would find his victims while he worked at the Swan Pub, convincing patrons that he was an undercover MI5 agent looking for potential connections to the IRA at the prestigious Harper Adams Agricultural College. During this whole time, he convinced John Atkinson, Sarah Smith, and Maria Hendy, eventually convincing them that his cover had been blown and they needed to go on the run. There's also this fabricated story weaved in there about Freegard suffering from cancer and wanting to like visit a bucket list of places around Britain.
Sure.
Eventually, he managed to persuade Smith to cut and dye her hair, as well as getting her entire £300,000 inheritance, as well as a £400,000 sum from Atkinson for quote unquote witness protection. Hendy, meanwhile, began a relationship with Freegard that lasted 9 years, and the two had two kids. Freegard did this to multiple people, sometimes promising marriage to different women in order to con them out of money. Eventually, he was charged with 2 counts of kidnapping, 10 counts of theft, and 8 counts of deception, which he was found guilty for and then sentenced to life in prison in 2005. But the kidnapping charges were eventually thrown out after his lawyers claimed that the people were not kidnapped, but in fact went with them of their own free will. Right. Mm-hmm. 'Cause brainwashing isn't a thing. So this allowed him to be freed from prison in 2009. And there's some other events that actually happen after he's released from prison, but you're going to have to watch the documentary to find out what they are. Got to hook you in. So have you had the opportunity to watch this?
I started it and then fell asleep.
Oh.
So I got about 20 minutes in and then passed out because it was a little boring.
Yeah.
Not going to lie.
Which is disappointing because this really is an interesting story. Like mm-hmm. the twists and turns and the amount of deception and like how...
I don't know if it's been the same people making Netflix pod or, you know, serial killer documentary crime things.
Yeah.
But the last few that have come out have been real shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I watched The Tinder Swindler, too, and that one was done in a very terrible way as well.
Really? Yeah. I just added that to my list this morning.
Actually. It's a good story, but it's a little like the way that they filmed it was a little like, ew.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I almost turned it off.
I mean, there's definitely I feel like there's definitely like a pool of directors and producers that they pull from mm-hmm. often.
I'm wondering if the last few have been by someone different. I haven't looked at who's been producing or, you know, any of that stuff. But yeah, the last couple that I've watched that have come out this year.
Yeah.
End of last year have been not so great.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, really, like, even if you're pulling from that pool of directors, like, a good documentary takes a while to make because mm-hmm. there's a lot of research and filming and sometimes years to mm-hmm. really have something to put together. So it's not like they can churn them out at the rate that people are consuming the content.
Yeah. And honestly, I'd be okay with waiting a couple extra weeks so that you don't make it look like shit.
Yes.
Make it look like it was a college project.
Yeah. Yeah. Better documentaries, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take your time.
I think just for the story, it's worth a watch.
Yeah. But don't start it when you're tired.
No.
Because it will lull you to sleep slowly.
Yeah. So that was The Puppet Master, Hunting the Ultimate Con Man. Before we move off of Netflix and Kill, I wanted to talk to you about this before we recorded. Okay. But little side note. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything about Murderville?
I actually started watching it.
How is it? I'm so anxious.
It's funny. Well, not all of them are... funny.
Yeah. So the whole thing with Murderville is it's starring Will Arnett, and they each episode have, you can tell, I haven't watched it yet, but mm-hmm. you tell me if I'm getting this right or not. Each episode they have basically special guests. Mm-hmm. But what I found out today is that they were not given a script.
Nope.
So, like, Will Arnett has a script, right?
Kind of.
And there's a general
idea.
It's very
improv. Yeah.
Yes. Almost the entire thing is improv, mm-hmm. like a detective show.
It is literally, like, an escape room. Like, a murder mystery escape room.
Yeah. I just think the concept is so fun. Mm-hmm. Like, and some of the stars they have on. I saw Kumail Nanjiani is on that. Mm-hmm. Did I see Conan O'Brien? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first one.
Like... just insane stars.
What's her name from Schitt's Creek? Alexis.
Oh.
Whatever. I don't remember her actual name.
No. Alexis, though.
Yeah, she's on there.
Yeah.
They have a football player. Yeah, some of them were very unprepared. You could tell.
Right. They're probably like, this sounds fun. And they go in like,
spot on.
They did not learn the yes and.
Yes. and but it's, they're very quick episodes. Yeah. They're easy to like digest, very fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they start off with Conan O'Brien, which is pretty great.
Nice. And oh my God, Conan's great. I just think it sounds like such a fun concept. I'm so looking forward to getting into that. Something a little, you know, murder light.
Yeah.
For it's sure.
It's definitely like, we had a forensic murder mystery thing that we did in middle school. It was like sixth grade science class where we had to determine if the stain at the crime scene was chocolate or blood.
Oh, I remember this. I remember this. Okay. Oh my God, I had totally forgotten that was a thing. Yes.
Sometimes I pull these memories out, but like that's the feeling that it gave me.
Okay.
Okay. Like they present you with all of these, like, here is evidence. And then you have to, like, they go and interview like two or three people. And then the person who comes on as the guest has to determine who is the killer.
Yeah. Oh my God. That sounds, yeah. It just sounds so good. Like, just the, I hope that it is successful because I think the concept really is like a winning concept. Like that's, that is legit, but
it's pretty fun.
Oh my God. I'm so excited. Looking forward to that. Yeah. Thank you for letting me take this little detour into something. Fine. But I was
watched it last night.
I cannot wait to tell Janelle about this.
Bo turned it on. I was like, oh my God, I was just going to tell you to turn that on.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, the new seasons of The Righteous Gemstones started.
Yes, I watched that. I've been watching Euphoria. Good. I watched Yellow Jackets is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just watched the new season of Queer Eye.
I haven't ventured into that yet. So but, good.
Be ready to cry, though.
The new, his other, Jonathan Vanessa's other show.
Yeah, Getting Curious.
Yes, that's really good. We started watching that.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, back to crime.
Crime time.
This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. This week we are going to be talking about some pretty serious shit, I would say. Murder.
Not so much for mine. I mean, there's definitely murder, but it's
murder,
got a twist.
It's mainly murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know me with the twists.
Oh, yes. We love a good twist up in here. Okay. So this week, I wanted to pull out a classic, you know, revisit our roots, really go back to where it all started. So this week, we are talking serial killers. Yes. Which, of course, as we all know, a serial killer, somebody who murders three or more people. It does not have to be like an exorbitant amount, although I feel like most people would argue one is too many.
Yeah. But if you're gonna do one, why not do more?
So this week I wanted to look at the case of Salvatore Perone.
Okay. Going outside the U.S.?
No.
Okay. I was like, because I went outside the U.S.
Think Staten Island.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Very much. Wish they were outside the U.S.
Very much inside the U.S. So Perone was married to Maria Salerno, and the two purchased this property in Staten Island. The house itself was kind of considered a real eyesore in the community. And honestly, the couple...
And that's Staten Island.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Sorry in advance, I think.
As a person with Italian heritage that comes directly from New York to Cleveland, I'm sorry, Staten Island.
I imagine this whole thing is very gabagoo. Oh, like, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Full gabagoo.
Full fugazi. We got it.
So the couple, when they bought the house, they actually had plans to do some renovations and do some add-ons and really like bring the house up to date. But before any of it could happen, the couple divorced and the house very quickly became just kind of a dilapidated mess. It was reported that at a certain point, Perone began dating a woman in Brooklyn and was only staying at the house like part-time, effectively ending any work that was being done at the house. According to Oxygen, quote, one a neighbor who wishes to remain anonymous told the Staten Island Advance that Perone began sleeping in the basement, calling him a nasty piece of work. So take that.
Classic.
What a nasty man. Mm-hmm.
Piece of work is a real Italian thing, too. Yeah. Call someone a piece of work. It was a PTSD response to that saying.
Like, oh, God. Now, previously, Perone had a few run-ins with the law. Besides collecting around 14 complaints about his home alone, Perrone had previously been arrested for drunk driving in Staten Island and New Jersey, as well as stalking, burglary, harassment, and public drunkenness in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
For work, Perrone was employed as an independent apparel salesman.
That.
Which.
He picks up things that fall off the back of trucks often.
Oh my God, I didn't even think about that, but that could be.
Nothing... Yeah, when you say you're an independent whatever, yeah, it's definitely just stealing things.
Nothing that I read gave me the impression that it was a seedy thing, but then I'm like, would it? Now that you said that, I'm like, would it? Because he did, what he did essentially was walk around to stores to try to sell clothing to sell in their store.
Yeah. Out of the trunk of his car? Yeah. I know a couple of these guys.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like it. That sounds about right.
I got this nice wristwatch. You want to come over and take a look at it? It's real nice. It's a Rolex.
He had hoped to eventually start his own clothing line, even filing for a trademark in 2007. And he was like relatively successful at the time as well, netting himself hundreds of thousands of dollars. An amount that would be down to only $1.84 in his bank account by the time he would eventually go to trial. Spoiler alert.
Wow.
So starting in the summer of 2012, a series of bodies were found in various clothing shops around the area. In the clothing shops.
Okay. Okay, yes. I'm just trying to follow here. Okay.
On July 6th, 65-year-old Mohamed Gabelli was discovered in his Bay Ridge clothing store with a single gunshot wound to the head. Only a month later, 59-year-old Isaac Kader was found inside his store in Bensonhurst, and he had been shot and stabbed. It would take a couple of months before a third body was discovered in Prospect Lefferts Garden, where authorities found 78-year-old Ramatola Vahidapur inside his store with gunshot wounds to his head, face, and chest.
That's overkill.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. The murders appeared to be connected as they all happened close to closing time. All of the victims had been, their bodies had been covered in clothing and other items from the store. And they found 22 caliber shell casings at each of the crime scene. So immediately they were like, this seems connected.
Yeah.
Police also managed to obtain security footage from near the site of two of the murders, showing a man walking with a black duffel bag, earning him the moniker John Doe Duffel Bag.
That sounds very Italian.
This John Doe Duffel Bag over
here. Yeah, it's a classic name.
I'll also say, because I can't honestly... I don't know why I wouldn't have put this in my notes, but I can't honestly remember if I did. I think just from his kind of like dilapidated house and, of course, all of this stuff, he also got the name Son of Sal.
Oh, Jesus.
His name is Salvatore?
Yeah. Yeah. That's so real stretch, guys.
They called him Son of Sal.
Oof.
I know, but I was like, I'm here for a good bad name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like Johnny Bag of Donuts, you know?
Johnny Bag of Donuts. Oh, my God.
The Italians.
Yes.
Not exactly the greatest at giving nicknames.
So this image, the security footage image, was released to the public, one of which was able to identify the stranger as Sal Perrone. Police were able to locate Perrone at a Bay Ridge pharmacy, and he was taken in for questioning. They were initially, like, taking this case extremely seriously because, obviously, not just because people were getting murdered, but each of the shopkeepers was of Middle Eastern descent. So they treated it in the beginning as a hate crime.
Yeah.
Which later, the hate crime portion of it would be dropped.
Okay.
Because the motives were, I think, significantly different. Mm-hmm. It was more of a hate crime of clothes, I think. A hate crime of fashion?
Fashion crimes. Extreme fashion crimes.
So, while Perrone was being questioned, authorities conducted a search of his girlfriend's home in Brooklyn. There they found the duffel bag from the videos that had been, it contained a .22 caliber sawed-off rifle, and a serrated knife that appeared to still have blood on it. Both of these things were sent to be forensically tested. The results came back showing the blood stains on the knife and bag belonged to two out of the three victims. And the gun was identified as the murder weapon thanks to ballistic testing. See junk science.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm not. We
footnote there.
Yes. I literally put like star see junk science because we could rehash it over and over again. We talk about it a lot. Junk science is a thing.
You can say so that it's of a similar gun. And yes. It's of a similar round.
Yeah.
But can you definitively say it is the same gun?
In this case, yeah, 100%. So Perrone was arrested on three counts of murder and three counts of criminal possession of a weapon. It became abundantly clear to authorities that Perrone was like a little unhinged and like really at the very least, he often provided multiple versions of his story. This is where for me it gets like kind of weird and really interesting, but just like kind of weird.
Okay.
So according to Staten Island Live, one version included a plan to promote world peace, which who could say no to that?
Okay.
Something we especially need right now.
Okay.
By the time it had gone to court, Perrone insisted he was being set up by a business associate.
Classic. Okay.
The New York Daily News reported that when Perrone took the stand in his own defense, something that went pretty much as you would expect it to.
Don't do that.
Especially when you get somebody who's kind of mad. Like they're just, anyway. So this is from the Daily News article, quote, Perrone doesn't deny surveillance videos show him toting a black duffel bag in the vicinity of the Brooklyn murders. But the former salesman swore under oath he swapped bags with an Iranian business associate by the name of Michael Bila, only to learn later that the bag he said Bila gave him contained the murder weapons, his own rifle and a serrated knife. He gave me a duffel bag, Perrone, 67, said during questioning from defense attorney Howard Kirsch. I put the duffel bag down. I never looked at that bag, he added, noting he did not bother to unzip the luggage. A man by the name of Michael Bila was unable to be found, of course. And he, like, continued to insist, like, you have to find this guy. His name is Michael Bila.
If that's your real name. Yeah.
He said that's not his real name, but you need to find this person. Like, just all very
I mean, even strange. If you use aliases, generally people will know your alias or find out your street name or whatever that may be.
Right, right. Perrone also claimed that he had an alibi for the night of Gabelli's murder, saying he had been eating dinner at his friend Luis Boschino's garment shop like he did every Friday, saying, again, from the Daily News article, quote, we have a whole gathering of friends. We're just a bunch of guys. Every Friday night, we would get together. I think they still meet. I don't know. I'm in jail. Which, fair enough.
Yeah, like, but also that's classic. You know, you have some antipasta, you play some cards.
I just love the idea of, like, I don't know what they're doing. I'm in jail.
I'm very clearly not there right now.
He was, of course, asked why none of these people were called to testify if he saw them every Friday.
Mm-hmm.
A question that went unanswered in lieu of a long-winded rant about 65 other witnesses Perrone had insisted weren't being allowed to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a ton of other weirdness in this case. Like you could get lost in just the articles about the like court proceedings themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Perrone eventually fired his attorney and attempted to represent himself.
Again, not a good move.
I want to actually read a portion of that exchange as reported by the Brooklyn Reporter. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Quote.
Ready.
Mr. Martin has done nothing in my interest. With all due respect, I can't do any worse than he's doing, Perrone contended. He has done nothing to pursue telephone records or anything. Judge Alan Maris warned Perrone of the significance of his decision and asked if he had any prior legal training, to which he responded that he had worked in the apparel industry and prior to that for billionaire business mogul George Soros. According to Mr. Martin, I'm charged with six murders, Perrone said. You are charged with killing three individuals, Maris told him. He told me I would be getting the death penalty, Perrone said. Mr. Martin knows there is no death penalty. You are facing life in jail. This is a very serious sentence you are facing, Maris said. Do you understand that you are taking a risk without having an attorney representing you? I can have the best attorney in the United States represent me, but without the video, I have no alibi, Perrone answered, referring to the MTA surveillance video of him that he said would clear his name during his last appearance in April. This guy is a fake. He is a liar, Perrone said of Martin. He's just running out the clock like Assistant District Attorney Melissa Carvajal. They are well aware if you run out the clock, you get no more Sprint Virgin phone records. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. Like,
oh boy.
Yeah, yeah. Those exchanges just kind of...
Yikes. Okay.
It's a lot. Yeah. And there's a video. I thought about including it, but there's a video where he is trying to get his first attorney removed, which if it's a court-appointed attorney, the judge has to approve it. Like, you can't just fire that attorney. So he was in front of the judge. And I always... There's part of me that feels really bad for these attorneys because... Like, there are some really bad attorneys out there. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not gonna lie. There are just bad attorneys. As you can see by the many, many ineffective assistance of counsel claims that we see.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some of those are legit. Some of them are not. Mm-hmm. But to be an attorney and have to stand up there while your client is like, I want him gone. He sucks. He's stupid. Like, I know the law better. Like, being a real Karen about it. And just have to stand there and be like, Your Honor, I've tried. Like, I've done everything he asked me to do.
Yeah.
You know, I just feel really bad because that's really fucking awkward.
Yeah.
It's like getting dressed down by a customer to your boss. It's just like, you know, we all know retail woes. So in the end, Perrone wouldn't actually represent himself. Instead, getting a court-appointed defense attorney named Howard Kirsch, who himself, like, afterwards made all of these comments alluding to the difficulties of working with him. He was just like, you can't work with a guy like that. Like, literally in news interviews, it's just like, it was impossible to work with him.
That's why he probably murdered people.
Yeah.
You don't want to work with me?
Fine. After a long and sometimes frustrating and outburst-filled trial, including Perrone himself being barred from the courtroom due to his outbursts.
Classic.
Perrone was sentenced to 75 years to life in prison in 2016, which was the maximum sentence allowed by law. After hearing heartfelt statements from the families of the victims who wholly condemned his actions, often sharing the sentiment that he rot and die in prison, Perrone had an opportunity to make his own statement, which again, went about as you would expect. He opened with, quote, my sincerest condolences to the families of the victims, before delving into what seemed to be a rambling 25-minute defense. 25 minutes. Most of which involved evidence he felt should have been brought in that exonerated him or provided him an alibi. There was like this, after he opened with my condolences, there was kind of like this interaction with between him and some of the victims' families who didn't wait that long before they just got up and walked out of the courtroom, which I get. At one point, he blamed his conviction on Kirsch, who was his appointed defense attorney, calling him a dum-dum. Like, this dum-dum over you.
So good.
Yes. As far as I can tell, he is still in prison. I mean, the dude was not.
Real schmuck.
He was a real schmuck. But that is the story of Son of Sal.
Woof.
John Doe Duffelbag. Sal Perrone.
All right. Well, as I stated, we're going to go a little trip.
Okay. I'm ready.
So I don't really like to cover the well-known guys on here because, you know, a lot of people do that. I like to try to stick to the niche. But for this, I wanted to go outside of the U.S. to try to, like, discover something else.
So, yes. Exotic lands, please.
I mean, not too exotic, but we're going to be going to Spain.
Okay.
España.
Okay.
To talk about their first recorded serial killer.
Oh.
Okay. History lesson.
Okay. So how long ago was that?
We are going to 1809.
Okay.
So during this time, brief history lesson, Spain was actually being ruled by a French Napoleonic puppet monarchy.
Okay.
And it was the beginnings of a revolt occurring for their independence. And at the same time, their Spanish-American colonies were also fighting for their independence. So it was just strife with war everywhere.
Okay. So Spain was trying to get independence from France. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile,
their colonies,
Americans were trying to get,
yep,
freedom from Spain. Okay. I don't know. I will definitely say I do not know as much about European history, mm-hmm, as American history.
Yes.
For sure.
This is also the time when anarchism started becoming a thing in Spain.
Okay.
Yeah. The 1800s are a wild time.
I see why you love this.
Yes. So this was the environment that Manuel Blanco Roma Santa was born into. He was born in Orense, province of Galicia, Spain. He was one of five children born to Miguel Blanco and Maria Roma Santa. Now, Manuel was actually born Manuela, as it was thought that they were a girl.
Okay.
Then at the age of six, they were deemed a boy and their name was changed.
Okay.
And we'll discuss that later because it's a little weird footnote, but also kind of important.
I already have so many questions.
Yes. Because Manuel could read and write, it was thought that they were of better standing. So not necessarily poor, but not also super rich.
Okay.
Growing up, Manuel had lots of hobbies. They loved to sew and read, and they actually practiced soap making.
Very cool.
In their teens, Manuel stopped growing, which was not normal for most children. That's the time, generally, when people have growth spurts.
Yeah.
But Manuel would only be 4'11 for the rest of their life.
Oh my gosh. So teeny That's tiny. So tiny.
Teeny tiny. And as they grew older, Manuel's career became that of a tailor, although some documents state that they were a dressmaker, but it's believed that they kind of made all sorts of clothes.
Okay.
It's just a matter of circumstance. Manuel did get married, but was unable to locate any information about his wife.
Okay.
Nevertheless, she did die in 1833 suddenly. Again, no documents on her death. It's all very weird. This is a time period where documentation was not exactly copacetic.
Yeah.
Especially during war times.
This is also the same time when, like, you know, two women living together were roommates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
And good friends.
Yes, yes. After her death, Manuel became a traveling salesman. So they also sometimes worked as a guide to take people through the mountains. And they really knew the area very well, the forests very well, very comfortable in the mountains. And they would often travel across Spain and into Portugal.
Okay.
So very comfortable in both of those areas. In 1844, Manuel's life would take a very strange turn. Manuel was charged with the murder of Vicente Fernandez, the alguazil of Leon, which is just a fancy term for a constable.
Okay.
Fernandez was on their way to collect 600 real, which is their money back then, from Manuel, who owed a merchant for some merchandise. Fernandez was then found dead, so naturally the blame was placed on Manuel because they were on the way to get money from them.
Okay, I can follow that logic.
Now, Manuel heard he was being searched for in connection to the murder, so they fled with a fake passport. They used the name Antonio Gomez as their fake passport name.
Okay.
Now, the weird thing that happened is that Manuel was tried in absentia. So that means that the trial went on without them, and they were sentenced to 10 years.
Absentia.
Okay.
Legal terms. I got you. That is a weird thing, and that still happens. Like, it's very rare that people are still...
I'm like, it's 1800s, so...
Yeah.
You know.
It's very weird that rare that people are still trying to absentia, because it seems like with all of the... Oh, God, what is the term for extradition? With all the extradition laws... It's easier to get people extradited back to the country that they're being tried in. Mm-hmm. I know of one, there was one recently that happened, but again, it was like somebody that fled back to India that wasn't coming back. And so they just tried him in absentia. But it still happens. Gotcha. It's okay. still a thing. Okay. It's a weird legal concept, but still a thing.
Yeah.
Feels kind of gross.
Yeah. I mean, this in particular was a little strange because there, you know, no actual evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also 1800s.
Times. Yeah, right.
So they fled to Portugal and began like a life on the run. And they would take these odd jobs doing things like spinning yarn and harvesting fields. They cooked, they did cleaning, and they befriended many women in the village. And often men would state, because of the work that Manuel did, that they were effeminate. So,
okay. Again,
coming in question of gender, it's very interesting. As a few years passed, women and children in the villages that Manuel worked in began to disappear. No one noticed the disappearances at first, as letters kept arriving from the disappeared to their loved ones. So, okay. You know, mother and child go on a trip, don't come back. But they still keep receiving letters. So they're like, all right, well, obviously they made it to their destination. The notes would often state that they were traveling or that they had arrived at a destination. They would write back soon, et cetera, et cetera. This was way back in the day when mail was, like, not traceable. So...
Right.
Who knows where it came from? Stamps weren't really like, you know, you can see now where everything comes from. Yeah. They stamp it right on the front. Yeah. But well, that wasn't super a thing.
All the stuff would arrive like weeks later. Like yeah. It also mm-hmm. wasn't like a couple of days. It's like mm-hmm. probably weeks since the whatever letter was written.
Yeah. So the other thing was that people would often hire others to write notes and letters for them if they didn't know how to write. Like if they could only read but didn't know how to write. So if it was in another person's handwriting, that's also not uncommon because if you don't know how to read or write, you might have somebody write something for you to send someone else. So
okay. That was a thing back then.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize that.
Yeah. So one day Manuel was caught trying to sell items from someone who had been missing for a while. And this raised suspicion in the village and ugly rumors began to circulate. This was the time where Manuel started to make soap again as his, like, main career. And there were rumors that the soap that he was making was of human fat from disappeared people.
Oh, no.
If you remember, I also did a story about an Italian soap maker who did the same thing.
Yes. Yes.
And Fight Club.
Yeah.
Just remember.
Yeah.
It's the most luxurious soap.
Oh, my God.
It lathers really
Oh. Yep.
So shortly after this, a few mutilated bodies were found in the woods surrounding the area, and they were so mutilated that they could not be identified. In 1852, someone filed a formal complaint with authorities in the city of Escolonia, accusing Manuel of using the fat of dead people to make soap.
Oh, my God.
But, like, this soap is too good. It has to be human fat.
It's stupid. I can't believe it's not human.
So, Manuel was finally arrested, and their passport was deemed a fake. They were then outed as Manuel Blanco Roma Santa, and they were taken back to Alariz. Now,
can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
So they were wanted in a different town that they had fled.
Yes.
Does that information get shared around to, like, neighboring towns to be like, look out for this person?
No.
Because obviously they wouldn't have not like a computer, obviously a computer system to just be like, is so-and-so wanted mm-hmm. in any other areas? Okay.
Generally not. I think because their previous job was like escorting people mm-hmm. through the mountains, I think it was a little bit more known, because if you're known as a person who, you know, does that, you might be more well known in other areas as well.
Gotcha.
So it was more because of the job that they had.
Okay.
Now, before the trial began, Manuel confessed to killing 13 people, and he said he did it because he suffered from lycanthropy.
Is that...
You know what that is?
You're familiar with that? Yes. Yeah. It's werewolf, right? It
means you're a werewolf, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Here's the twist.
Okay. All right.
So, werewolf
this
lore.
I gotta say, this is not the twist I expected.
Is it ever? Are the twists ever expected?
No. No.
So, werewolf lore in mountainous regions goes back hundreds of years, and this was, you know, not just Spain. It was everywhere. Everywhere that had a mountain had some sort of werewolf lore. And even though this is the late 1800s, like barely before the Civil War time started, people still believed in werewolf lore. So people believed him. And his claim of being a werewolf was sensationalized.
Oh my God. Do you have to like provide any evidence of being? Like, did they put him outside in a full moon? Oh my God. Okay.
Here's what happens. Okay. So during this time, there was also a horrible famine going on in the region. So this tale that was covered was like all over in the news. And in a testimony, Manuel claimed that they had been cursed and did not kill those people until they transformed into a werewolf. So obviously not liable. It was werewolf me. So this is a statement from the trial that Manuel gave.
Okay.
The first time I transformed was in the mountains of Cuaso. I came across two ferocious looking wolves. I suddenly fell to the ground and began to feel convulsions. I rolled over three times and a few seconds later I was a wolf. I was out marauding with the other two for 5 days until I returned to my own body, the one you see before you today. Your Honor, the other two wolves came with me, who I thought were also wolves, changed into human form. They were from Valencia. One was called Antonio and the other was Don Gennaro. They too were cursed. We attacked and ate a number of people because we were hungry.
Okay.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Now, when the court asked him to demonstrate his transformation, he stated that the curse only lasted 13 years and he was no longer able to transform into a wolf.
You just missed it.
Just missed it.
It's like, yeah, I would.
Ooh, but that was last week. The curse ended. Oh my God. Just straight lifted.
I wish there were things that worked like that. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God. I have so many things. It's just like, ooh, I got like 5 minutes and then my 7 years is up and then I can never do it again.
No, I'm so sorry. Like, oh my God. Now, a doctor was called to examine him because obviously people are like, well, maybe, you know. But they wanted to make sure that he wasn't totally insane. And they also did check him for werewolfism. Now, you're probably asking, what? They checked him for that? And yes, they checked him for that.
So, okay.
Let me show you how.
Okay.
His doctor was a heavy user of phrenology.
Oh,
that old Lord. Thing, guys. You know, that old cranial pseudoscience that we love so much.
Phrenology is not real, y'all.
No, it's not.
So it's especially just so we're
not,
clear.
Also, like, not a determining factor of werewolves, like, at all.
Also that. Also, 100% cannot tell werewolves.
Cannot. I feel like
as
this should be.
Needed to be said.
This should be 100%. Have you ever seen Arcane Bullshit?
No.
I love Arcane Bullshit. They make the weirdest posters and stickers and the darkest, weirdest shit. This should be an Arcane Bullshit poster.
Oh my God.
Phrenology cannot determine werewolfism.
I mean, true. Accurate statement.
So his head shape stated that he was totally okay, not insane, and especially not even a werewolf.
Well, okay.
His thorough
glad
dome,
we cleared that up.
His thorough dome examination determined he was totally fine and fit. So they stated that he was not exhibiting any symptoms that would lead them to believe he was dim-witted or maniacal, so he was not insane.
Okay.
And those are direct quotes. He's not dim-witted or maniacal. So the trial went on for a year, and Manuel was acquitted of 4 crimes, as it was determined that they died from actual wolf attacks.
Okay.
That's the other twist.
So 4 of them
so
were
four
actually...
So 4 people actually died from being attacked by wolves.
Can we talk about the fact that he's more willing to be like, I am a werewolf, I killed and ate these people, than to just be like, yeah, I murdered a couple people. Like, that is the thing that you're more okay with. Mm-hmm.
And it's just super weird that he wasn't a werewolf, but 4 victims died from wolves that he was accused of. So, like,
that's funny.
A little weird. But he was found guilty of 9 murders as they looked like they were cut up.
Okay.
Strange. Now, on April 6th, 1853, Blanco was sentenced to death by garrote with R1,000 compensation to be paid for each victim.
Okay. You're just making shit up now. Death by garrote?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, a few months later, Manuel's conviction was reevaluated and his sentence changed to life in prison.
Okay.
People were like, maybe not kill him.
Maybe not death by fucking garrote.
It's Spain.
That's
man.
So weird. Why was that accepted?
I mean, it wasn't like.
Let me just grab this wire.
People were Jesus. Still using all kinds of weird shit.
Okay.
Well, in this case, it would have been a rope, not a wire. So even worse.
God.
But then the conviction was overturned again and the original sentence reinstated of death by garrote.
Okay.
Now, this case made its way around the newspapers and caught someone's eye. Someone by the name of Mr. Phillips, who was a Brit, wrote a letter to the Spanish Minister of Justice stating that Manuel wasn't in control of themselves at the time because they had clinical lycanthropy.
Okay.
What is that, you say?
Yeah, what is that?
It is a mental disorder where someone believes themselves to be a werewolf so much that they act like what they perceive a werewolf to be. So he thought that he was a werewolf and he imagines himself transforming into that and then probably murdered those people in a manner in which he thinks a werewolf would.
Okay.
Okay.
This seems like a stretch.
It is.
Also, Mr. Phillips, totally real.
So the letter.
Totally real person, right?
I mean, it was an alias.
Okay.
But they stated that they had successfully treated someone with this disease using hypnosis.
Okay.
They pled with them to have his sentence overturned again and that they needed to seek psychiatric help. So the Spanish Minister of Justice wrote to the Queen, Isabella II, and she was like, okay, yeah, maybe he really is insane. Now, at this time, hypnosis was and like psychiatry were becoming a thing.
Yeah.
And people used hypnosis a lot to treat psychiatric problems.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of electroshock therapy, also a lot of just poking your brain with sharp objects.
Yeah, this was definitely like the era of the rise of attempting to treat mental illness, which a lot of people up until this point thought that they were just like touched or, you know, like some magically bullshit going on. And even in the early days, like psychotherapy and any of these psychological doctors. Were kind of not super accepted early on.
Like no, it was like definitely a quack science
type of thing. Yeah.
People still believe that it's a quack science.
Scientology.
Yeah. So, I mean, but it's also the intricacies of the brain. Like we will never understand our brain fully. Never.
True.
And if anyone claims that they can or that we are close, do not believe them.
They're either fake or selling MLM stuff.
Yeah, we will never be able to understand the intricacies of our brain.
Yeah.
So Queen Elizabeth II was like, okay, this makes sense. You know, she was a pretty big believer in medicine. And so she had the sentence commuted in May of 1854. Manuel was transferred to Celanova prison and they died there a few months later. Now, the record and this prison are long gone, but there are two theories about their death. One, Manuel died from a disease shortly after arriving. Obviously, prisons aren't great, especially in Spain. No one gives a fuck.
Yeah. Even if they were, medicine was not great.
Yeah. You wouldn't get treated.
Yeah.
The other theory was that Manuel was shot by a guard after repeatedly being asked to transform into a werewolf. They grew angry and killed Manuel. So He's the like, guard was like, transform.
Do it.
Be a werewolf.
Do it.
Do werewolf stuff. Do lycanthropy. Go. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
And they were like, I can't. My curse is gone. It's been lifted. So they're like, all right, well, bye. Shoot you in the face.
Oh, my God. Sure.
Now, there are conflicting accounts of where Manuel actually died as well. So the death is kind of a mystery, but we know that they were gone by 1863. Okay. So now, in recent years, Manuel was being looked at again, but not for the case or even the lycanthropy. But instead, people became very interested in knowing more about why were they identified as a female at birth.
Okay.
It is believed that Manuel was considered one of the first documented cases of an intersex person in Spain.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Since it was not the olden, olden, olden times. Sometimes doctors perform surgeries on children at this time to make them fit into a gender binary. And it's not for certain, but the declaration of Manuela to Manuel at age 6 might suggest that male qualities appeared more predominant than female qualities, and that it might be quite possible that they underwent a surgery to definitively make them male.
Yeah. And let's be real, like, that can fuck you up, especially at a time where the idea of a gender binary and, like,
is really becoming predominant.
Yeah. And like, the thinking of somebody outside of a binary gender was, like, not a thing at all, like, not even on the radar.
Yeah.
And especially for people living with it, having to, like, suppress any feelings that weren't within the little box, like, that could be so damaging to your mental health.
Yeah. And the other case that was made for it was the fact that they had proclivities for activities that were considered feminine. So the soap making, the sewing, the fact that they stopped growing when they were in their teens.
Yeah.
If they were intersex and did have surgery, that could stop you from actually fully becoming, you know, whatever you're supposed to be.
Producing hormones to deal with puberty.
And there are like hand drawings of Manuel, and a lot of the descriptions, you know, they were balding, but they always described them as having, like, very feminine eyes and, like, long eyelashes. Okay. They would talk about that a lot in the descriptions of Manuel. So it's believed that they were intersex.
Yeah.
There's actually an artist who created works based on this based on the case for the PH Museum in Italy. And it was called Lobsmuller. And you can check that out. It's, like, really haunting photography. We could put the link in the show notes, but if you go to PH Museum and check out their exhibition section, it's this beautiful black and white, and some of them have a little red tinting to them. It's very dark noir photography.
Yeah.
But that is the case of Manuel Blanco Romasanta, or Manuela. Oh,
so interesting. That was a very interesting
case. Yeah, it's fucking weird. It's very weird. Yeah. And I consciously, like, started writing he because all of the writing said he. But then as I started reading it, I was very, like, they, because we don't really know exactly what sex they were.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, they were kind of forced into being a male.
Right.
But still, like, didn't have another wife. Still was very, like, by themselves.
Yeah.
Did a lot of, you know, female considered activities.
Yeah. I think that does add, like, a certain layer to this whole story, because we really are, I think, especially now, as we are talking about gender and sexuality being a spectrum, which it is, really, like, it just is a new concept to us now, right? Like, within the last 10 years of people finally.
Concept to us now in the Western world. Let's put that caveat on there.
And by that, I mean becoming more accepted. Mm-hmm. It's not there yet. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work to do, people.
Yeah.
Don't be closed-minded, you know. But
that series that I was talking about with Jonathan Van Ness,
he
has an episode about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they have an episode.
He's gender non-binary.
Yeah. They prefer they.
Well, I think on an episode of Queer Eye, he said he, she, they.
Yeah.
So.
But in this episode, they definitely said that they were non-conforming and went by they. So, like, they talked to a two-spirited person and they discussed it. And it is very, like, very much an 18th, 19th century thing that started happening that pushed this. Previous to that, it wasn't too definitive. It was it was more, like, medical at birth kind of a situation. And then all of a sudden it started to change. And that was in the Western world. If you go outside of that.
Right. Yeah. No, we're always slow to catch on, because we have a lot of close-minded dumbasses in our country. Sorry to say.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sorry to say. There's a lot of stupid people that live here.
Yeah.
That's true. But the fact is, like, that only adds to any issue that you would have, any other issue that you would have, right? Like, not fitting in this tiny little super hyper religious box, I'm assuming, because that in the 1800s, religion played a part in everything.
Yeah.
I just feel a lot of empathy for them, because it can't have helped to just like have someone decide your gender for you, and then you didn't really have a choice because then you're ostracized, and that's not great for business.
And the switch that they made was at 6 years old, when you're fully conscious of your body and you as a person, and are beginning to become you.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird time to do that.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is, we love everybody.
You do you.
You do you. We love people of all genders and sexualities. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It makes the world a better place.
Yeah.
Because who gives a shit? Just do your thing.
Exactly.
It's fine. I just want everybody to be happy and get along. World peace. World peace. Let's do murder.
You've been watching the Olympics too much.
Oh my God. Do not. Before we started recording, I went on like a 10 minute rant about the Olympics.
Tiff and I are like,
which I very much love, but is controversial this year for obvious reasons. Do not.
I mean, it's controversial every year.
It is, but more so this year. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm not even going to get started on that. I could just go forever and ever and ever. So if you.
In closing.
If you are looking for another true crime podcast just like us.
To stop you from watching the Olympics.
To avoid the Olympics. No, watch the Olympics. Or don't. I don't know. I feel conflicted.
I feel conflicted.
Well, check out this podcast. Just do that. Check out this podcast.
My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley. And we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter.
At Murder and Such.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Janelle, that has been our episode.
Sure has.
What a fun time.
What a weird time.
It is really like our roots of just like real gritty true crime.
Yeah.
Type stuff.
And of course, me coming in with the weird curveball. Right.
Werewolves. Which, fine.
The paranormal.
Yeah. So, what do we have coming up? I know we got something.
Oh my gosh, speaking of paranormal. Beautiful segue.
Yes.
This week, guys. Gals. They's thems. We have a podcast festival in Elgin.
Yay!
Dark Matters is happening. It is the 25th and 26th, but we will be performing on the 26th, 5:30, one of those times.
Check our social meds.
Yes. I am not good at remembering things.
Me neither.
I'll be there.
I forgot to put it on my calendar until this morning. So.
But I am supposed to be there. It's $10 for a pass for the entire festival, so you can see whatever you want for $10. And you go to sidestreetstudios.org. Let me sound it out for you. And you can go there and get your ticket in advance. There will be lots. We're the only true crime, but there's lots of paranormal and weird freaky deaky stuff happening.
There is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was trying to
They've pull got ghosts.
Up.
They've got aliens. They've got all kinds of stuff. I think there's one in Spanish. Like, there's so many things.
Okay, I wanted to see. So they've got Bob After Dark, Ghostly Podcast. There is going to be an AMA I think we're going to try to go to before all of this starts. So if you just want to come and talk to us.
Again, we don't remember anything until it happens.
Yeah. There's going to be tarot readings in palmistry, Graveside Paranormal. We will be there. Rob Southgate Graphic Tales. This looks like a UFO.
Yes, that's the aliens
ghost thing. Yeah. Radio Lucifer. Those are all people that are going to be there. So if any of that sounds interesting, you can check that all out at sidestreetstudioarts.org. / Dark Matters will take you right to the.
Yeah, it is. I think it's also right on the front page.
Yes. Yeah. You just click on the thing. Click.
Yeah.
Yeah. But come in, check us out. It's Side Street Studio Arts and Ghostly Podcast. We like Ghostly. They did a great job with the Fringe. Mm-hmm, we worked with them at the Fringe. So anyway.
Yes, they recorded us. It was fantastic.
Yes, it was wonderful. They're both wonderful. Okay, so check us out.
That's what we got.
February 26th.
Yes.
All right. And that's it. That's all we got for you today.
That's all we have. That's all we know that's happening.
Yes. So far. You know what? I'm glad that it's like early on in the year. It's nice to just be getting out to like do something and doing a live show. Mm-hmm. I would encourage everybody to get vaccinated before they come out for the live show.
Masks are required too, just in case you didn't know that.
Yes.
Side Street is very stringent with their policies.
Good.
Lots of signs everywhere.
Solid. I approve.
Don't be a jackass. Yep. Just do what they ask you,
yes,
please.
Yes. No fighting.
So you can enjoy a nice show.
Yeah, we want to see you guys there.
And then be angry afterwards.
I feel like all of our listeners are cool. They're probably doing what they need to do. So
just respect their space. That's all.
Respect the authority.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not really authoritarian.
No, they're not.
They're very non-hierarchical.
Yes.
But, you know, they're trying to be respectful of all the peoples. So.
All right. With that, if you enjoyed this episode, you can find more like this at badtastecrimepod.com. Where we also have links to our merch page and to our Patreon. There's a donate button. You can go right there if you want to hear more. We also haven't talked about reviews in a while.
Is that a thing still? Do people still do that?
It's still a thing.
I don't listen to iTunes anymore.
Me neither. But if you like the show, why don't you leave us a positive review on whatever app you happen to be listening on?
Go on YouTube. Leave us a comment.
For sure. It does.
Watch all of our stuff.
With that being said, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, the Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Don't turn into a werewolf.
Ow.
Or I'll cover you on the podcast.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form or another.
What else can we call him? Freddy Fashions?
Freddy Fashions. Oh my god.
That's a good street name.
Freddy Fashions.
Freddy Fashions.